this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey guys, let's start this episode with a quiz for Wheeler.
Okay.
Four names I'm going to read out Wheeler here, and if you don't know these names and the role they played in Texas history,
okay,
we're going to remove this chair from the podcast. We're just going to go it alone.
The answer is they're all from Tennessee.
How'd you know that?
I
read the names.
I know what you're going to do.
Sam Houston, Davy Crockett, George Childress, John Wharton.
This is a setup.
So Texas wouldn't be Texas if it weren't for Tennessee, as I continuously tell you.
I think you've reminded me of this many times, and that's what people from Tennessee who've moved to Texas who want to, you know, fit in Texas say.
Is that it? We want to fit in
it
here.
It is legit, though. There are some big names that were from Tennessee who helped it all become possible here. Right. And I knew the answer to that question because I knew what your trivia was going to be because...
You're sitting behind me. You can see my script.
Well,
here, right?
I can't read that, but we've been together long enough that I know what you're going to do
jokes.
To me. You have me outnumbered here on this podcast today in the first place because you're a Tennessean.
And our guest today.
Jonathan Scrimeti. And it doesn't look like it sounds. It looks like it's missing a vowel on here, but it's S-K-R-M-E-T-T-I. He is the Tennessee Attorney General. And first of all, can you kind of walk us through what brings you to Texas?
So I was down today for the Southern Baptist Convention speaking at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission lunch.
And Y'allitics, of course.
And Y'allitics, yes. Because you know it's a given, and you were right next door anyway, so we just pulled you over. Before we get started, and we talked a little bit about this before, your position is a very interesting one. I mean, an attorney general position in any state is an interesting position, but you are sort of on your own in how you get to that office.
Yeah, so in Tennessee, it's very unique. In most states, it's elected. In Texas, you've got a big election coming up. Mm-hmm. A few states, the governor appoints. A few states, the legislature appoints. In Tennessee, the state Supreme Court appoints the attorney general. So I need three votes, and it's an 8-year term.
8 years.
And you're not even halfway through this yet, right?
Yeah, about 2.5 years in.
Wow.
So what happens if the Supreme Court at some point has buyer's remorse on somebody they choose? Is there a mechanism, or are they just stuck with you for 8 years?
The legislature can impeach me.
Okay. So there's always that. But what an interesting position to be in because it's almost like it sort of frees you, doesn't it? I mean, you don't ever have to worry about campaigning.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no fundraising. I just need to focus on doing the job.
Well, let's talk about the job here. You're the highest legal officer in Tennessee, obviously. You lived in Memphis for a while. That's where you met your wife, you mentioned. Former federal prosecutor, worked in the Civil Rights Division. You prosecuted sex traffickers, corrupt government officials, violent white supremacists as well. You taught for a while as an adjunct professor at the University of Memphis. Let me see if you've heard of these here, Wheeler. A few degrees from universities I haven't heard of. I haven't heard of these. George Washington University, University of Oxford, and Harvard here. But the reason we're
Harvard's familiar. Yeah.
It sounds a little familiar
right now.
It is in the news. But listen, the reason we're having the Tennessee Attorney General on this episode of Y'allitics is he's involved in leading some big cases that have had some nationwide attention lately, big implications nationwide. Let's talk about one of them that we're waiting on a Supreme Court decision any day now, and this is U.S. versus Scrimeti. This is a significant case in transgender rights. You were defending, was it Tennessee Senate Bill 1, SB 1?
SB 1.
There, which essentially it bars gender-affirming care, sex changes for anyone under 21, or under 18.
Under 18.
Yeah, under 18, I guess. Tell me how this one came about, though, because like Jason said, you're not an elected official. What's the genesis of this lawsuit?
So the legislature found out that there were juvenile gender transition procedures happening in Tennessee. They got very concerned about this. They had hearings, and a bipartisan supermajority of the Tennessee legislature passed this law, SB 1, brought by Jack Johnson, the Senate Majority Leader, HB 1, William Lambert, the House Majority Leader, and it prohibited doctors from giving kids these transition treatments. You know, the evidence is pretty significant that there are problems here. You see the European countries that had embraced this backing off and saying that evidence just doesn't support these life-altering interventions for kids. But legally, a few states had tried it. District courts had enjoined the laws. We were the first state to win. So we had a district court enjoin our law, but we took it up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. We won, and then the Biden administration and the ACLU decided they would take a shot at the U.S. Supreme Court. The court took the case, and now we're waiting on the decision.
So you argued this in December, and it's always, I mean, you know, we're trying to read tea leaves here with the high court, but what was your sense walking away from that? I know what a lot of the headlines said, and they said that it looked like your side looked like it was going to prevail just from the way things went.
You know, you never want to take anything for granted. There are a lot of different issues that came up in the argument. I thought the argument went very well for us. I mean, we were able to get out everything for Tennessee that we had hoped to get out in the arguments. I thought our briefing was very strong, but the courts had months to consider it, and you just never know what conversations are happening, what research is happening. So, you know, until we see the decision, I'm going to be on pins and needles waiting to see what happens.
Now, of course, you have strong opposition on the other side of this. You know, people who say that you're essentially taking away body autonomy from people, and that you're, you know, getting into the doctor's office, which should be, you know, something between a person and their doctor or their family and the doctor. You know, you're a longtime member of the Federalist Society, which believes in very limited government. How do you square those two things?
So I think government should be limited, but there's a purpose for government. And, you know, in this situation, there's significant evidence that the medical sort of background has been manipulated for political reasons. Alabama had similar litigation. They found a trove of documents showing political activists, Biden administration officials, social justice lawyers telling the researchers what to include and what not to include in the document that was the gold standard for medical treatment. And so the actual medical evidence is much less supportive of these treatments. That's what the European countries found when they started really looking into it. Even though ideologically they had jumped in and said, well, if this is going to help kids, we want to do it. Over time, they saw that the evidence just wasn't bearing it out, that there was a huge risk to children, you know, potential lifelong sterility, lifelong loss of sexual function, all sorts of bone density and blood issues, cognitive development issues. And most kids who have gender identity issues outgrow those issues. Some don't, and it's a very serious condition. But most kids that struggle with this ultimately grow out of it unless they start on the treatments. So there's a pretty good reason for the government to take a hard look here, and particularly because the number of kids seeking these treatments has absolutely skyrocketed in the last 15 years. So there was a doctor in England who said he's seen a 4,000% increase in the number of adolescent girls that were looking for these very serious medical treatments as a result of their gender identity issues. And when you have huge numbers of kids suddenly looking for very serious treatments, and we can't understand why that is, that's a really good time for the government to step in and say, we really need to make sure this is an evidence-based treatment, and here the evidence is lacking.
If you get a favorable ruling in this case, though, that would set a nationwide precedent.
Yeah, this is the first constitutional case looking at gender identity issues that the court's taken.
Wow. Was this your first time in front of the Supreme Court?
I didn't argue the case. My Solicitor General did. But yeah, it was my first time up at the desk.
What was that like?
Everybody says you're so close to the justices, but then you get there and you are so close to the justices.
How close are you?
Justice Gorsuch was just a little bit further from me than you are.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So you are way, way, way up there.
Wow.
And there, you know, there are a lot of people in there. And this was a case that aroused a lot of passion. So, you know, there were thousands of protesters outside on both sides and a courtroom full of people who are really invested in the case. So it was a little bit electric.
Yeah, and this is an important case that people are watching on both sides of this issue, too. Do you feel that gravity when you're in it? Do you take that in? Are you numb to it at that point?
We knew this was a significant case going in. I've got a great team. They worked so, so hard on the briefing and prepping for argument. And you really do feel it. I mean, you know, it's a little weird because it's got my name on it, and I don't want to get too big for my britches about that. It's kind of awkward, but you know, this case will have substantial consequences in terms of law and policy, and potentially thousands and thousands of lives.
This is very visceral too for the other side.
Yeah.
Do you ever sense that? Do you feel that? What is your connection with the other side on a case like this?
You know, the neat thing is before the argument, everybody who's going to sit at the tables is back in the lawyers' lounge together. And so Chase Strangio, the first transgender advocate to argue in front of the Supreme Court, was hanging out back there, and, you know, some members of the ACLU and Lambda Legal team. And obviously, there's a lot of disagreement here. We have very different ideas of what the Constitution says and what the right policy is. But everybody understood this was a big moment. And there's a camaraderie of the law. I mean, we work in a profession where you're supposed to disagree and where the act of disagreement is supposed to produce better outcomes. It's like democracy or like the free market. You know, it's the adversity that drives better results.
And even though you're appointed by the Supreme Court, this is deeply mired in politics, though.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not my job to say what the law should be, but it is my job to represent the state. And in this case, you know, the state has some very strong arguments. I was very happy to be the tip of the spear, and my team did a great job advancing the cause. But you know, the law is the law regardless of the political background. I mean, what the Constitution allows, what the Constitution prohibits, shouldn't change based on the political valence of a particular question.
That's not the only big case that has major name national in recent months and years here. Let's talk about the Ticketmaster thing. And there was a suit that came to a beloved Tennessee school that I'm sure both of you are very familiar with. There was an investigation, I guess, and you filed suit in that case. Talk to us a little bit about what happened there.
Sure. So I'll start with the NCAA case, which is the best case I'll ever work on in my life.
That's the best one.
Oh my goodness.
That's one of my questions here too. So tell us why it's the best.
So this is an organization that has been completely insulated from accountability. They make arbitrary decisions. Their enforcement is extremely harsh, except where it's not. They play favorites. And it's really undermined people's confidence in the system. And great, I mean, I know Tennessee, like Texas, holds college sports in extremely high regard.
Yes,
so
it does.
I have to be careful. There were other things out there more important than college sports. This is not the case of the century, but the NCAA has been a bad actor for a long time, and they have seen the train coming down the tracks in terms of name, image, and likeness rights. I mean, everybody knew there was a problem here.
And this is where athletes can cash in almost as though they are in pro sports and actually make money off of their name. Their
universities can pay them, right?
Well, I mean, we're getting to that point now. Yeah. But yeah, they have an intellectual property right in their image that they can market. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court had recognized this. The NCAA didn't really respond very thoroughly, kind of said, we're in the Wild West, there are no rules. And then a couple months later, they started deciding to very aggressively enforce their rules on NIL. And UT was one of the initial subjects.
Now you have the
original
be specific
UT.
When you say UT.
The pastel orange
people
UT.
Think University of Texas.
It's a common mistake.
Uh-huh.
The SEC, when it lists the teams, has clearly defined who UT is and who Tex is.
So University of Tennessee is what we're talking about.
But
yeah.
Let me ask about the NCAA for a moment. How does a settlement ensure that small schools can compete just like big schools can for athletes?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the ultimate outcome is in terms of what the structure of college sports looks like.
So this isn't done.
This is not done. What we did was say the rules that you're enforcing violate federal antitrust law,
okay.
And you can't enforce them. Ultimately, we need federal legislation to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people have a lot of creative solutions. We have the House settlement coming out of California, which is more of a consensus outcome. But all it takes is a few people filing lawsuits and potentially the consensus breaks. So until the federal government steps in with an antitrust exemption and legislation defining exactly how this should work, it's always going to be uncertain.
But you went after the NCAA because they were targeting the University of Tennessee.
Well, I mean, they were violating the law in a way that hurt all student athletes in Tennessee, but they were specifically looking at serious consequences for UT. And you know, that's a $500 million in economic activity in East Tennessee. That is a really significant part of the state. So it wasn't just a matter of saying, we're gonna support our team. It was a matter of looking at some really outsized consequences that were being unfairly imposed in an arbitrary way in an overall system that just doesn't make legal sense.
So what was the outcome of that suit? You guys settled? And what's the outcome?
That was in March, right?
We settled in March. We got an injunction originally. We got a preliminary injunction against enforcement of the NIL rules. And then we reached a settlement that said they're not going to enforce these rules. They're not going to retaliate against any Tennessee institutions or student athletes. There are some checks built in so that we can look at the new rules as they come along and raise any issues we have with them and potentially litigate the new rules. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think viewing this as anything other than transitional is a mistake. There is an endpoint somewhere in the future that's going to make sense and it's going to stabilize everything, but ultimately it's got to be Congress probably working with the administration making that happen.
But if I'm an athlete now, what's my bottom line after this settlement?
Did they change with the settlement?
You can get paid. You can get paid for your name, image, and likeness rights. Mm-hmm. And you know, the House settlement tries to put some guardrails on that. In terms of exactly what people can do, you know, there's caps on the schools.
And if I'm shopping around, though, from school to school, can I know what that looks like before I commit to somebody? Because it's almost like I would be blindly committing before finding out what they can do.
So that was actually the problem that we sued over. Under the old rules, you were able to negotiate with the school, but only after you committed. Mm-hmm. And so you couldn't really know what the different possibilities were. And so the market forces that are supposed to benefit the consumers, in this case the student athletes, couldn't work.
This will affect athletes in Texas as well.
The NCAA, you know, I was hoping it would be a Tennessee and Virginia only settlement.
Come on.
That would make for a couple good national
championships.
I thought
you Tennessee folks like to help us here in Texas. That's what we started with.
But now the NCAA decided they couldn't enforce the law, just in, you know, a couple states.
What made that your favorite case?
It was a very popular thing to do in Tennessee.
Yeah.
I mean, we showed up.
You're legendary on campus now, right?
We showed up for the hearing, and someone had a crane with a giant Power T banner hanging there across from the courthouse. Uh-huh. And you know, people care about it. I mean, you know, that they didn't like what the NCAA was doing. I think everybody recognizes the rules are a mess, and they loved that the state was willing to step in and fight.
Let's talk about the Protecting Kids on Social Media Act. Texas has tried to pass this. This is essentially a law that says kids under 18 can't have social media accounts. Texas's bill got pretty far recently and ended up dying at the last minute. Your law, though, just went into effect in January. Have you had any enforcement actions yet on any social media platforms?
We're in litigation on that, so I can't talk too much about the legal specifics of it.
Is that separate from the Instagram suit, though?
So we are also suing Meta over consumer protection violations related to the mental health impact on teens of the social media platforms.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that separate, but are you already in litigation on someone who's violated the Protecting Kids on Social Media?
They sued us.
They sued you guys over it, okay.
Yeah.
But here's the thing that I was asking here in Texas, too. What's to stop a savvy 16-year-old from using a fake ID or a VPN from getting around this?
So you're never going to have 100% compliance. But that's the case for every law. I mean, you can have laws against murder. It doesn't mean murder doesn't occasionally happen, but you're trying to deter it. And with respect to the kids, the more obstacles you put in their way, the older they're going to be when they engage, and the more likely that a number of kids will follow the law. And, you know, we've seen more and more research on the impact of these platforms on kids, mm-hmm. and it's had a terrible effect. I mean, I'm not anti-social media. I think it does a lot of good for the world, but there's a lot of data out there showing just massive mental health impact across the young population.
Yeah, we've talked about that here on the podcast quite a bit, but October of 23, now almost 2 years ago, is when you led the coalition of 42 states suing Meta for Instagram and the doom scrolling that it allows and a number of other things that it allows there. In this lawsuit, still ongoing, right? There's no settlement?
Looks like we're probably going to get a trial date next spring.
Well, what are you trying to get out of this? What's the whole goal of this?
I mean, my goal is we need the platform to be safer for kids. Mm. You know, they've refined it so carefully. They have more data than any company's ever had in human history about their users. You know, when you look at Google and Meta, TikTok, nobody else competes. I mean, maybe Apple. And they have done everything they can to make every single element of the platform promote engagement. You know, the tone that dings when you get an update, the duration between when they send you updates to try to get you back in when you stop using it, the colors of the interface, all of this has been so carefully tested. They know exactly what they have done to make it irresistible, and they just need to dial it back some. And, you know, if I were in a position to tell them exactly what to do, I'd probably have a higher paying job somewhere. They know what to do. But
what's a safer experience for kids, though? What does it look like? Time limits on there?
You know, maybe time limits. Maybe they just dial back some of the engagement engine. You know, if this is just potential theoretical things, but you know, if you stop the infinite scroll, which is one way that people get sucked in, If you don't send the kids any notifications at night, if you don't let them log in at night, potentially, if you have controls on access during school hours, you know, the things that they do to get people to engage and engage longer, they're very aware of what they do, and they're in a position to dial it back.
Yeah, I will say that my life became probably more relaxed than it's ever been when I went to Do Not Disturb. None of those notifications dinging. It's amazing what that does to you, how it trains you to, respond.
General Scrimetti, he's been on Do Not Disturb, though, for as long as I've known him, for like 15 years, though.
That should tell you something. I've been on it as long as I've known him. Yeah, okay, what does that tell you?
So, long before Instagram.
So let's loop back and talk about Ticketmaster now and Live Nation, because so we're talking about how you were popular on the University of Tennessee campus for taking on the whole name, image and likeness thing. How do you do with Swifties? Because there's another Tennessee icon, and you took them on because of her concert and the experience that a lot of them had trying to go, but they couldn't get in.
Yeah, it was the breakdown in ticket sales when they were selling the first round of tickets for the Eras Tour, if I remember right. And you know, Ticketmaster has been it's harsh to say, but a ruthless monopolist for like 30 years. I remember when I was in college and high school, you had bands going to Congress to testify about the problems. And the market's changed a little bit, but the core of it is still an issue. They have interlocking products that make it really hard for people to effectively compete. And that comes at the expense of consumers and of artists and of all the people who are engaged in the music industry. You know, Tennessee is a state that is just absolutely saturated with music industry.
Oh, yeah. It's huge.
And it's just not right. I mean,
so are the bots buying up all the tickets? Is that what was happening, and people just couldn't get in?
I mean, that's part of it. A lot of the issue is just the representations that are being made. But at the end of the day, it's really the structure of the market that's the legal problem that we're ultimately looking at. I mean, there were consumer protection issues that we could have gone after, but what's driving all of it is the monopoly.
And whatever happened with all the fees around all these companies? Ticketmaster, SeatGeek, all these different companies. Was that legislation or was that legal issues that were...
There's been a lot of legislation to try to bring more transparency to the fees and to try to put limits on some of the fees.
Not part of this suit, though,
this,
right?
This is a Sherman Act, strictly antitrust suit. We're in it with the DOJ. We're in it with a number of other states.
It's bipartisan, too.
Very bipartisan, yeah.
Do you do a lot of that?
On the consumer protection and antitrust areas, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's funny because in the constitutional cases, we have very strident fights. I mean, huge, epic legal fights. But then we lock arms against some of these giant companies where they have so many resources that if we didn't work together, we'd be sunk. And so when the Biden administration was suing me and I was suing the Biden administration and we were fighting, on the antitrust front, Jonathan Cantor up there was a good friend and we did a lot of work together. There are Democratic AGs who file very spirited amicus briefs on the other side of some of our cases who are great partners on the consumer issues.
It's kind of good to see that, though, too. I mean, people want politicians to go at it and lock horns to, further what they believe when they go to the voting booth. But I think they also want them to get along and make progress happen, especially on broad agreement items like that. Kind of dovetailing out of that, you seem like a very quiet, very affable guy, not the typical politician that we might be used to. We don't see a lot of that in politics or hear a lot of that in politics, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on whether we should.
I mean, I yearn for a more boring era. I mean, politics is not supposed to be this interesting. But, you know, ultimately, for most AGs, it's an elected office, and the people get to choose, and the people choose generally sharper edged folks than me. That's what the process results in. And so if people want something different, I think a lot of the people in these jobs are truly trying to be good representatives of their voters. And if people wanted them to behave differently, I think you'd see AGs behaving differently. I think you'd see Congress people behaving differently.
So it's really not them, it's us.
At the end of the day, the system is accountable to the people.
Yeah. Let's talk about a red-hot political issue right now, states' rights, especially with what's happening in California. President Trump federalizing the National Guard in California. Is that an abuse of states' rights? He's legally within the lines, but is that an abuse since the governor traditionally calls up National Guard?
So it's legal. As far as I'm not an expert on the Insurrection Act, but I looked at it, and it sure looks like if federal law enforcement is being prevented from enforcing federal law, it's an option. In California, you had the mayor of Los Angeles saying, we will not stand for ICE enforcing federal law. Now, I understand this is a super sensitive topic. People care a lot about it. There are families that are very seriously affected. But at the end of the day, we've essentially been ignoring the law for a long time, knowing that it's still lurking out there. And we've got a president who was elected in large part because he said he would enforce the immigration laws. So I understand there are people that don't like the way he's doing it. You cannot attack federal law enforcement officers when they're doing their job. We have a legal system. You know, I sued the Biden administration a bunch because I thought he was doing things that were illegal. Yeah. We have a court system to resolve that.
But as far as making politics boring again, I mean, what would it hurt for somebody in D.C. to pick up the phone and say, listen, we see what's happening out there in L.A., Governor Newsom. Call these guys up. Don't make us do it.
It's an option. I mean, I do think the fact that the mayor initially came out and said, I will not stand for this, we will not stand for this, puts you in a much different position than if you're, you know, if you're having a disagreement and you can just call and say, hey, we're gonna figure this out. I mean, it's so polarized, but you can't have people trying to burn down the federal building. You can't have people throwing things at ICE. Now, it seems like California is maybe shifting its posture. Maybe they're trying to step in so that there's not a need for federal enforcement to come in and protect the federal law enforcement agents. But for a stretch there where it looked like it was going to be just straight up oppositional, you don't want to see that. But that's exactly the kind of situation where the federal government needs to be able to back up the federal laws.
And that's not a violation of any state's rights as far as you're concerned.
I mean, I would be very upset if it happened in Tennessee, but at the same time, I think if we were allowing violent opposition to federal law to happen, if we had officials that were intimating that they might be willing to participate in that opposition, you know, the federal government is a limited government, but it's also the superior government. So the states are supposed to do most of the things, but where the federal government has the authority to act, it's allowed to do what it needs to do to enforce its laws.
But do you think you would look at a potential lawsuit on the grounds of states' rights if this did happen in Tennessee?
We'd be very aggressively researching it. You know, people are allowed to file lawsuits. I've glanced at California's suit. I think they're going to have a challenging time given the letter of the law, but I haven't done a deep dive on it. And we have a court system that's there to ultimately resolve these issues.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever check up on other states and say, that's probably a good argument to file?
Oh, yeah.
They do it to you, too, right?
Yeah.
They do it to you, too?
Yeah.
But let me ask you about a case that we've covered a lot here. This is Forever Chemicals. It's really kind of surfacing as a huge issue.
PFAS.
Yeah, PFAS. Mm-hmm. You sued 20 manufacturers of PFAS. What's the goal of this lawsuit, though? Is it to clean things up? Is it to take things off the market? What is it?
It's to clean the water. I mean, these are chemicals that travel through the water supply, and they get into the food supply, and they get into people, and they stay in people. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a lost cause at this point, right? Like, we've been consuming this stuff for ages.
Yeah.
I've got little kids. They're going to have kids someday, and I want us to clean the water as best we can, you know, constrain this stuff. There are uses, as I understand it, where we just need these chemicals. But I think they've been allowed to get out into the environment in ways that are potentially pretty harmful to people. We know about it. It's time to clean it up. You know, we don't need to get a bunch of money out of the companies except for the purpose of doing what needs to be done to remediate the environmental hazard.
What's the status of this, General?
It's ongoing litigation. I mean, this is very complicated litigation. You have multiple entities. There's some bankruptcy issues. You know, there's allocation of...
It'll take a minute.
How important, though, is it to lock arms in a bipartisan way with other states and go, we're all in this and we all feel this way? I mean, this is a problem everywhere.
Yeah, it's the only way it happens. You know, when I was the chief deputy attorney general a few years ago, we did a lot of work on opioids. And it was consistently referred to as the most complicated litigation in American history.
You were heavily involved in that.
Yeah, Texas was too, but yeah. Tennessee was one of the lead states. We put a ton of time in. And if the states had not been able to come together and work in a bipartisan fashion, I don't know how we'd ever get a resolution that got the amounts of money that we were able to obtain that are in Tennessee and a lot of other states pretty much exclusively dedicated to remediating the opioid problem.
You have to stay a united front there for sure. Another current event, you're a Harvard man. What do you think of what's going on with the Trump administration in Harvard?
Yeah, higher education has just gotten way off track and way too ideological. And there was a backlash coming for a long time. And I think people should have been taking steps to mitigate that beforehand. There are some institutions in America that are very old that have done a lot of good things over the years. Harvard is a world-class institution. It has produced incredibly consequential research. Some of it terrible, right? Like some of the stuff that came out of Harvard Law School over the years, I'm not super thrilled to wave the flag about. But
big stuff has come from there.
Big stuff has come from
now
there.
We're seeing funding being pulled back. Are you worried about that?
There has to be a course correction, and academia needs to understand that it benefits from public trust that only comes when the public trusts the institutions. But I really hope that we don't burn these institutions to the ground. I mean, America is the best country in the world for higher education. And I think there is a way to get us to a place where higher education is not an ideological preserve that's being used to bludgeon middle America. The universities need to understand that they have gone way off track. They need to acknowledge it. They need to find a path back. But I hope that ultimately the federal government and the universities are able to find common ground. There have been some big changes. Academia got way, way off track and way entitled.
What should Harvard be doing right now, do you think?
I think Harvard needs to do a comprehensive look at admissions policies, at internal hiring and promotions policies. We're not involved in any litigation
sure.
on this. But I think
you're an alumnus, though. Where did it get off track, and what does it need to do to get back on track?
Yeah, it became more and more and more of an echo chamber, shutting out voices that disagree to the detriment of the quality of scholarship that came out. I mean, if you look at the makeup of the faculty, right, it's, maybe generously, maybe 1-2% Republican. America's pretty much a 50-50 split, and people come up with all these rationalizations, oh, Republicans just don't like higher education. But I think there's got to be some fundamental recognition that it's become an echo chamber that people have been pushed out who disagree. And the whole reason that universities enjoy the legal benefits that they do is as an avenue for people to throw ideas at each other, to refine them, exactly like the legal system works, exactly like democracy works, exactly like markets work. You're supposed to have a clash of ideas that ultimately benefits the American people.
Speaking of clash of ideas, so you've been on the forefront with a lot of these different cases that are, big social issues of our time. People joke here in Texas that if you want to know what's going to happen next, watch what's happening in Florida. There's sort of this race to see who's going to be the most conservative. Tennessee is no shrinking violet in that concern. What is your thought about that as far as these states? It's like, there's several states that seem like they're trying to lead the way for the conservative cause. And what are your thoughts about Texas?
I mean, Tennessee has a lot of affection for Texas. I think of it as the fourth grand division, right? You've got the three grand divisions of Tennessee,
Jeez.
And then we planted another star down here.
This is far west Tennessee.
Competition is good. And one of the ways that we benefit from competition in America is different states trying different things. And I know, California has a very different approach to things than Tennessee does. Sometimes they have an illegal approach to things. But they feel the same way about us. And you want people jockeying to be the best that they can be. And I think the competition between our states, and there are some other states that are certainly trying to get into the mix too, creates better and better and better conservative legislation, helps us figure out how to litigate these cases better. It gives us the feedback both from different legislatures where, Texas, I think, is a bit more balanced than Tennessee's General Assembly. So you're getting different voices in. We have six Democrats in our Senate. I mean,
we have 11 11.
It's pretty skewed. And one of the risks when you have a really skewed General Assembly is you don't hear as many voices, or they don't have as much weight critiquing some of the problems. So the more people that try things, the more different approaches they take, the more feedback you get, the better the ultimate product you get. So I think it's great that everybody's jockeying to be the most right-wing state in the country.
Last question for me. You have until 2030 in your position here. What's next for you after this? You've kind of been a teacher, federal prosecutor, private practice.
You're asking him to fast AG. Forward through the next five
it's,
years
yeah.
and
it's,
tell
it's,
us
it's
what
a,
he wants.
It's a long way off. it's been a long time.
But does Mrs. Scrimeti say it's enough of this stuff?
She... She has some idea of my market value in the private sector, and that will ultimately prevail, I think. But yeah, I love my job. I love my team. I love my state. It's been a really long time since we've had a two-term AG. I don't know if that's a possibility. I don't know if the court's going to be inclined in that direction when the time comes. Mm. And you know, it's a long way off to prognosticate. But I think I have it really good. You know, every former AG that I've talked to, and I hear that people I haven't talked to, they all say being AG is the best job they ever had. Mm. Bill Clinton apparently still tells people that the best job he ever had was being the Attorney General of Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And you've got the autonomy to move. You know, the Senate is appealing, but you got to work with 99 other people, and they don't get along so well up there. You know, when you're the governor, I got little kids. I got to be at home. You know, the governor, especially in Tennessee, where we have a constitutionally pretty weak governor. I mean, our constitution is designed to make the legislature very powerful.
Yeah.
You get blamed for everything, but you don't necessarily have the authority to change things. I went to law school. I really like being a lawyer. I feel like I've got the best legal job in the country.
I'll finish with this. You know, it seems like back in more quaint times, most people wouldn't even know the name of the Attorney General in their state. It's a very powerful position, not just in your state, in this state, in all of these states. Do you get that sense? Has that changed? And if so, what happened?
So in 2007, the Supreme Court decided Massachusetts versus EPA, which says essentially that states have more standing than anybody else. And they, you know, they backtracked on that a little bit since then. But when they did that, a lot of people realized if the states bring the lawsuits against the federal government, they're more likely to get in front of the Supreme Court. There's more, you know, we're probably going to be able to thread the jurisdictional needles that we need to make the arguments in front of the court. And so you saw AGs suddenly get, I don't know if weaponized the right word, but get a lot more active, a lot more prominent. It's always been a stepping stone in the elected states. But it's really become a very prominent position. I mean, Ken Paxton is a nationwide name.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in these legal issues that everybody cares about that are going to be universally resolved through the Supreme Court, those are in the hands of the AGs now. So it's a position that is rapidly evolved. And I think you're still seeing people start to grapple with the fact that it's a less sleepy position than it used to be. It's a more prominent, more national position than it used to be. And that's had a real effect on the way the AGs operate. It's had a great effect on our recruiting. I mean, we're able to get awesome people to come work for us because they know that they're going to be in the middle of the most important and significant cases in the country.
Yeah, the work matters because you see gridlock in legislatures, you see gridlock in Congress, and so a lot of these issues are now getting decided in the courts, and who's bringing it to the courts? You are.
Yeah.
Pulled pork or brisket, which one?
I mean, pulled pork.
You Tennessee guys, geez.
A
brisket with
there.
A really nice thick bark on it?
Brisket's great. I will not knock brisket, but pulled pork is barbecue.
That's good.
General, all right, we're going to have to ask you to leave now.
I'll be escorted out of the state.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much
Thank
for having me.
Thank you very much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.